You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we'll learn about department stores in the 19th century, where browsing was a form of women's liberation. And we'll trace this retail feminism to today.
First, according to a new report from the Wisconsin State Journal, 22 Wisconsin hospitals have been fined by the state over the last handful of years for not complying with a 2008 law. Under that law, hospitals are required to offer emergency contraception, sometimes called morning after pills, to victims of rape.
Supporters of the law have said that emergency contraception can greatly reduce rape victims' fears of being impregnated by attackers and also reduce abortions overall. But some of the hospitals that were fined were Catholic hospitals that cited religious freedom for not complying with the law. And some lawmakers have also encouraged challenges to the emergency contraception requirement on those grounds.
Sarah Finger is the founder and executive director of the Wisconsin Alliance for Women's Health. She joins us now to tell us more about this law and enforcing it. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, give us some background. You were there, as I understand it, when this law was put into place. What was the reasoning? What was the perceived need for it?
Well, I back in 2004, this fight really started. This was something we had seen as a public health standard, and we had conducted a survey of Wisconsin hospitals and found that only one third of them were providing this kind of standard, comprehensive, compassionate care. And so it really made for our argument to get law passed in the state to ensure that when a rape victim is seen at a Wisconsin emergency room, that they're at least informed about and is dispensed emergency contraception as a way to prevent a pregnancy from her attacker.
So that law, as we mentioned, was passed in 2008, and then there's the question of compliance. And now this new report from the Wisconsin State Journal looks back. What kind of things did we see?
Well, we're seeing too many hospitals being cited as not complying. Just to give you a little bit more background about the law itself, this ended up being a bipartisan bill that actually finally got passed in 2008. And it was after several legislative sessions, they came to an agreement that actually the religious directive number 36 of the Catholic faith actually says that providing emergency contraception and allowing a rape victim to prevent a pregnancy from her attacker is actually the compassionate right thing to do. So it had bipartisan support. It got passed. But the sad thing is about policy and legislation is that it's one thing to get the law passed, but it's another to fully implement and have it complied with. So here we are now in 2016 or 2017 now, over 8 years later, finding that we still have too many hospitals in Wisconsin not ensuring that rape victims are given this standard of care.
Now, we've seen, we mentioned 22 different hospitals fined over the years since it was passed. Some of those were, you know, a few years ago. This isn't all 22 happening in 2017. Do you hope that given that those fines were assessed over time, that more hospitals are now complying?
I certainly do. We took the initiative back in 2008 and again in 2015 as an organization to create a toolkit for hospitals and healthcare providers and local advocates. We did this, unfortunately, because the Department of Health Services had not necessarily put this kind of compliance toolkit in place. So whether or not there wasn't enough guidance, whether or not there's just not awareness of this law or the state's not doing enough to get the word out, we're definitely, again, seeing over the course of time a number of these hospitals, and we mentioned right before we got on the air that these are just the hospitals that might have been audited or checked into. We don't know if there are more hospitals out there that aren't in compliance that haven't been caught yet.
Talking to Sarah Finger from the Wisconsin Alliance for Women's Health about a law in Wisconsin requiring hospitals, emergency rooms to provide information about and access to emergency contraception for people who are victims of rape. Do we know, based on coming into this law or what we know now, how often this is an issue at emergency rooms around Wisconsin?
Well, we actually have some estimates that show, in terms of who is showing up to the emergency room, only 32% of assaults ever get reported or those individuals are ever going to the emergency room. But it's estimated that over 300,000 women are raped each year, resulting in over 25,000 unintended pregnancies and 16,000 abortions. So for those that actually are able to get care, to go to an emergency room, we want to make sure that these individuals are not having to shop around for the kind of compassionate, comprehensive care. But we're also very much aware of that a lot of women who go through these tragic circumstances don't always seek help or care.
And one objection when we talk about emergency contraception on any level, some people opposed to abortion say that, at least in some circumstances, emergency contraception is the functional equivalent of a very early abortion. What is your response when you hear that argument?
You know, in 2017, it's amazing that we're still having these kind of political fights over preventing unintended pregnancies and abortions. You know, this was something we had to fight hard around back in 2008 and before getting the law passed, was explaining that this is prevention. That if you were to have an existing pregnancy, which this law allows you to test for an existing pregnancy and not have to comply with the law if a pregnancy is found, but if there was a pregnancy and you were to give someone emergency contraception, it has no effect on that pregnancy whatsoever. It's not a termination at all. This is the compassionate standard of public health care that exists from all of our healthcare experts.
And as I understand it, the law specifically says if the rape victim in this case is tested to be pregnant, the hospital is not required to provide abortion services.
Correct. That was one of the agreements we had made with the legislative authors and some of the parties involved, was that, you know, and again, we know there is absolutely no impact that it has on an existing pregnancy, but to give some of these individuals comfort in knowing if there was a pregnancy or not, you can test. And obviously, if a woman is already pregnant, having emergency contraception is not necessary.
As I understand it, when the law was first introduced, some lawmakers wanted to amend it to say that hospitals could opt out of this requirement on religious grounds. That ended up not happening. And as you said, this did pass with bipartisan support. Looking back, what would you have thought of that kind of exemption?
I think it's absolutely unnecessary. When you look at this legislation, it's not meant to mandate that any individual that has an objection is not required to provide the standard of care. What it does is make sure that the hospital and the institution and the emergency room itself has policies in place so that there's someone on staff at any given time to make sure, again, that this rape victim is informed about and dispensed emergency contraception if requested. So this is not, you know, doing anything to threaten an individual's conscience. It's really about making sure that, again, protocols are in place so that emergency rooms, when they receive a rape victim, are not, again, denying this woman this compassionate way to prevent a pregnancy from her attacker.
And in this Wisconsin State Journal report, some hospitals have said, you know, they may have been fined, but they're saying, we were complying, we just weren't documenting it right. We weren't leaving the correct paper trail. That sounds kind of mundane, but is it important that we are tracking this to make sure that there is compliance?
Absolutely. I work with a lot of the forensic nurses that work in these emergency rooms, and they have brought up the concern that it's been a matter of documentation in some of these citations. This is why we try to encourage the Department of Health Services to actually create the kind of form and the kind of protocol themselves so that there were no gray areas. Whether it is documentation, I've heard some of the nurses say that if a woman had had a hysterectomy and there was no chance for her to get pregnant, they may not have informed that rape victim about emergency contraception. So whatever the reason is, I hope that the state, the Department of Health Services, some of these advocates, these sexual assault nurse examiners, and hospital staff can work together to make sure that they're crossing their T's or dotting their I's and no one is falling through the cracks.
We'll leave it there for now. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Sarah Finger in the studio with us. She's founder and executive director of the Wisconsin Alliance for Women's Health. She joined us to talk about 22 Wisconsin hospitals that were fined in recent years for not complying with an emergency contraception law that applies to rape victims.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump signed an executive order recently reinstating the Mexico City rule, which prevents international health organizations receiving U.S. aid from talking about abortion with their patients. We'll learn more in a bit about what this could mean.
First, we're looking at the heyday of department stores and the role they've played in women's lives. In the 1800s, middle-class women found shopping at department stores a kind of liberation, free from the constraints of their home and away from men. Washington Post reporter Jeff Goh joins us to discuss the feminist history of the department store and where we find it today. His recent article is titled "The Secret Feminist History of Shopping." Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, take us back to middle-class Victorian England, where shopping was a housewife's first real taste of freedom. What did the department store have to do with this?
So this is a part of history that I don't think many Americans realize, which is that shopping was an important feminist activity back in the day. And so in the 1800s, in England, which is where a lot of these shopping arcades started to pop up, there was a culture of separation of the sexes, and the women were expected to stay at home, and if they ventured outside, it was mostly just to gather ingredients for dinner or to buy things for the house. And so what changed is that in the middle of the 1800s, there was a lot of manufacturing that happened, and this democratized a lot of household goods, like furniture, became really affordable for a lot of households. And so women, the task fell to women to buy all of these things. And to accommodate them, a lot of stores started popping up in urban cities. And what happened was women all of a sudden were starting to go into cities to go on shopping trips. They were hanging out with their girlfriends, and to accommodate them, you know, stores started serving tea. They started popping up little tea shops where women could take a break during their shopping trips during the day. And this really opened up the city, which used to be a male-dominated space, to Victorian women.
And you said in your article that women had some privacy in department stores, that they had a sort of shell around them. Do we, and whether they spent money or not was beside the point, do we shop in department stores in the same way today with this same type of philosophy?
I think that's something that we have lost. And one of the reasons that department stores even were created in the first place is that shop owners wanted to create a space where women could feel comfortable. And at that time, it was still very strange for a woman to be wandering the streets alone. So they wanted to create kind of a partially enclosed space where women could shop, they could get some food, they could hang out, without feeling like they were totally exposed. And so that was the thinking behind the department store. But quickly, it turned into, I think it was an empowering space for a lot of women, because they could use shopping as an excuse to socialize in public. They could wander a little. They had a little more agency. And that's something I think that we may have lost in our shopping culture, because, well, I think of that as a good thing, because nowadays I think most people think of shopping as a chore. I think a lot of shopping has moved online. And that's good, because now we have, a society where, we don't have to shop in order to, socialize. We have other ways of doing it.
What could department stores do to bring back browsing, a place where women would want to flock to and spend time in?
I think that there's still a tradition around the holiday season where stores try to entice consumers with, Santas, with elves, with various displays, and so you still do see some of that. And that is one strategy that stores have increasingly relied on in recent years as more and more shopping moves online. But on the other hand, I would question whether, it's that important to make shopping the central feature of our social lives. And I wonder if, maybe it's a good thing that instead of hanging out in malls, we're sharing selfies or, watching Netflix together.
And women lead hectic lives. It's been documented that they work these long days outside the home and they juggle more than their fair share of housework. Is going shopping just to browse even considered a pleasurable activity today?
I think that's a very tricky question, because if you enjoy shopping, by all means, men and women, you should just go and shop and enjoy yourself. But what's funny is that in Victorian England, there was an expectation that this was part of a woman's duty. And so what was so interesting about shopping is how many women turned that into something else they subverted that expectation and they made it into, instead of a household chore, they turned it into something of a private pleasure. And what was really interesting as I was doing reading for this piece is I learned about the connection between shopping and the roots of early feminism in the UK. And the way that that worked is that, you know, women started to realize that they wielded a lot of economic power because they were the main tastemakers for their households. They could decide where to shop and where not to shop, where to spend their money and where not to spend their money. And so this became a feature of many protests early on in the course of, you know, first wave feminism, where women, you know, they would boycott stores that they felt didn't support women's rights. They would also smash windows and, you know, stage violent protests in order to promote their cause. And that's something that would only be possible because women had already, stores had helped usher women into the center of civic urban life.
Yeah, the same place that gave them some independence was the grounds for protest.
Exactly.
We're talking with Jeff Goh, who's a reporter with the Washington Post who covers mostly economic issues, about the secret feminist history of shopping, a recent article. And Jeff, the Industrial Revolution, you mentioned textile industry humming in the 1800s, churning out tons of stuff. So fast forward to today, do you see a game changer like the Industrial Revolution that would alter the relationship between women and department stores?
I think we have to question, first of all, why shopping is still, in a lot of circles, thought of as a women's activity, because it shouldn't be. There's nothing inherent about shopping that makes it a woman's duty, and there's nothing inherent about shopping that makes it, you know, that makes it more pleasurable for women than for men. If anything, the reason why we still think of shopping as something that is largely a women's activity is because department stores were designed to cater to women, 100 years ago, and so they've continued that tradition. And so it's kind of been a self-fulfilling prophecy, because these stores recognize that, you know, women are their main customers, and so they adapt themselves to fit what they think of as female tastes. And that's why, you know, the culture, it's still, you know, thought of as strange for men to shop, and why it's thought of as strange for men to enjoy shopping. And so that's all of a cultural thing.
Is there anything that department stores today, as they see their demise in so many places, is there anything that they could learn from Victorian England, from their past, and apply it today that might help win back customers?
I think that the appeal of shopping and the pleasures of shopping have not diminished. And I think the problem is that now that we can shop and peruse on Amazon from the comforts of our own home, where we also have, you know, cookies that we can eat, and where we don't have to spend all day on our feet carrying around shopping bags, that's the main challenge that stores face now. And the only way to compete with that is to create a retail experience that is fresh, that is novel, can get people off the couch, and whether that is in some places, you know, free samples, whether that is, you know, really beautiful window displays, which, you know, some stores still do and some very successfully, and whether that is, you know, a closer partnership between, you know, brick and mortar stores and their online counterparts, in order to allow people to, you know, try out things in a real store, mm-hmm. but then also have the convenience of having it delivered to their house.
Take us to the suburban shopping mall of the 1980s and 90s, where teenage boys and girls roamed freely like the movie Mallrats. Does that have an association to what was happening in the early days of shopping malls?
I think that you see a parallel in that this commercial space also became a social space, and it became a place where people could exercise in a contained environment some freedoms that they wouldn't be able to experience elsewhere. And so I do see a parallel between, you know, teens spending an afternoon in a shopping mall and some of these early Victorian women who might hang out. And by the way, back then, it was very strange for a woman to be alone. She usually had to be accompanied by a male chaperone. But shopping, the shopping culture changed, and so it became acceptable for women just to hang out, you know, a pack of girls or a pack of women going to you know, going downtown to buy some clothes or to buy some furniture, that became socially acceptable.
Before I let you go, if department stores and shopping malls are dying this slow death, as we read about, will we grieve when they are gone for their social aspect that they brought and their history of what they did for feminism?
I think so, and I think that anything that that gets you out of the house these days can be thought of as a positive thing, and even just the act of, you know, of walking around, of meeting your neighbors and meeting the people in your community, that has been a function of bazaars and marketplaces for centuries, and that's something that we're losing now that we, you know, so many of us just click some buttons on Amazon and something arrives at our door.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Washington Post reporter Jeff Goh. We've been talking about how department stores helped women be liberated in the 1800s and what that relationship is like with the female shopper of today. His recent article is The Secret Feminist History of Shopping.
Coming up, we'll learn more about the Mexico City rule, public health, and abortion under the Trump administration. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. To Central Time, I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Reveal. In 1988, two powerful explosions shook Kansas City, Missouri, killing 6 firefighters. 9 years later, 5 people were convicted of arson and sent to prison for life, but were they innocent? Reveal investigates problems in the case and whether federal agents pressured witnesses to lie, as one of the defendants will soon make his case for freedom before a federal judge. That's coming up tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, in President Trump's first week in office, he signed an executive order reinstating the Mexico City rule, or as critics call it, the global gag order.
The order was signed by President Reagan in 1985. It restricts foreign aid organizations which receive U.S. funding from providing or promoting abortions to women. Furthermore, it limits what doctors are able to talk about when it comes to abortions and family planning.
Rachel Robinson joins us now. She's an associate professor in the School of International Service at American University. Rachel, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, bring us up to speed on this executive order. How broad is it, and what exactly does this order do?
Sure. Well, as your little intro there suggested, it makes it much harder for non-U.S. organizations to do anything related to counseling or mentioning abortion as a possible outcome for women. That's sort of the way that the policy has been in the past. What's new this time around with Trump's reinstatement of the policy is that the sort of conditionality that organizations have to agree to has been extended much further. So before, organizations just had to say that they wouldn't use any of their funding, be it U.S. or not, to quote-unquote perform or actively promote abortion as a method of family planning. If they failed to do that, then they would lose their U.S. family planning assistance. Now they're at risk of using all of their U.S. global health assistance, so whether it's for HIV/AIDS or maternal and child health or family planning as before.
Take us back to the mid-1980s, the Reagan administration, when this Mexico City rule came to be. How it was perceived then and over the administrations, how it's perceived now?
Sure. So it was originally instated by President Reagan during the International Conference on Population, which was held in Mexico City, hence the name. There's no other connection beyond that. And it was very much the result of abortion politics in the U.S. But it was also facilitated by Reagan's very active dislike of the United Nations. So implementing the policy sort of took the U.S. off the hook for its contribution in particular to the United Nations Population Fund. The policy then stayed in place throughout the presidency, the rest of Reagan's presidency, and then through George H.W. Bush. It was rescinded by Clinton, then put back in place by George H. Bush, and then rescinded again by Obama in 2009. And so it's come to be highly symbolic of U.S. abortion politics, you know, to the extent that Obama was even criticized for not rescinding it fast enough after he came to office in 2009.
How have countries around the world been impacted? How has healthcare been impacted?
Well, the best research that we have at this point indicates a really chilling and negative effect on health. So in particular, research conducted by Aran Ben David and colleagues at Stanford has demonstrated that in those sub-Saharan African countries that are particularly reliant on U.S. funding for family planning, there was actually a link in the 2000s between the decrease in access to contraceptive services that occurred because of the policy and then an increase in abortions. So abortions actually increased.
And does any U.S. aid actually pay for abortions?
No, and that has been the case since the 1973 Helms Amendment to the U.S. Foreign Assistance Act. So that has long been off the table. So opponents of the Mexico City policy often argue that it sort of goes above and beyond what's already written into law.
So how much of this is about politics, about abortion politics, in your opinion?
Pretty much all of it. it's hard if the justification is to reduce abortions and then research shows that's not the case. It becomes very difficult to justify the policy.
As you look around the globe, how are NGOs reacting? How are physicians, health workers moving forward in this situation?
Well, as the history sort of indicates, this is something that, you know, most of these people and organizations they're familiar with. And it was absolutely expected that this was going to happen under the Trump administration, and it would have happened, you know, any Republican presidency. The thing that these organizations and people have to deal with is essentially a lot of uncertainty. And so at this point right now, most of the uncertainty is really about what this further provision of the policy means, so by extending it to all global health assistance and not just family planning. But the uncertainty is really, it has damaging effects. So the policy it makes the funding environment unknown. So organizations are often not sure if their activities would actually make them ineligible for funding, or if the funding that they're receiving from another organization might actually have come from the U.S., and so as a result, they will err on the side of caution when the policy is in effect, thus, you know, potentially reducing services and sometimes unnecessarily. And so my sense is that, you know, this particular effect of the policy might actually, unfortunately, be greater this time around.
Do we have any hard data out there that shows this policy is reducing the number of abortions around the world?
Not to the best of my knowledge, no. The one study from Ben David et al. From 2011 just showing the increase in abortions.
We're speaking with Rachel Robinson right now about the Mexico City rule, which was reinstated by President Trump in his first week in office. She's an associate professor in the School of International Service at American University.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this Mexico City rule? What role do you think the United States should be playing in providing foreign aid? And should abortion or even talk about abortion be off the table for groups getting aid from the United States? How about family planning and foreign funding of that by the U.S.? Give a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue. continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're continuing our conversation about President Trump's decision to reinstate the Mexico City rule, which prevents any foreign aid organization receiving U.S. money from not only performing abortions, but advising women on abortions. We're speaking with Rachel Robinson. She's associate professor in the School of International Service at American University.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the president's decision to reinstate this Mexico City rule, the gag rule, as critics call it? What do you think about the political back and forth with each change of party in the White House? The rule is rescinded or put back in place. Do you have questions about this Mexico City rule, what it means for doctors and their patients around the world? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, Rachel, women are still getting abortions illegally in many cases. How might this order affect how doctors provide post-abortion care?
Yeah, that's another big unanswered question. So in the past, post-abortion care, the so-called care that women receive in the event that they've had an abortion and perhaps, you know, something has gone wrong, or they just need family planning services. In the past, there's been sort of an explicit statement that that is still acceptable. That it's not clear at this point whether that will still be the case. And so that cuts off a major avenue of care for women. And, you know, deaths due to unsafe abortions are a major cause of maternal mortality the world over. So this has ramifications, it's, you know, beyond sort of the abortion element of it. If we're serious about reducing maternal mortality, there needs to be post-abortion care.
Yeah, and what are the repercussions here beyond abortion? The health issues like HIV/AIDS, cervical cancer, child health, what's the ripple effect?
Yeah, so family planning saves lives. It helps reduce maternal mortality by preventing pregnancy that occurs, you know, too early, too late, or too close together. And that those are the sort of three areas that really increase the risk for women. But it turns out those are the same factors that are associated with infant mortality as well. So there's, you know, very direct links through family planning. And then in addition, it turns out that, you know, providing family planning to women who are HIV positive is one of the main means of preventing mother-to-child transmission of HIV. So, of course, women who are HIV positive have the exact same rights as everyone else if they wish to have children, but many of them, you know, do not. And so ensuring that they're able to prevent pregnancy as well is a major pathway through preventing infant transmission of HIV.
Let's bring in Steve from La Crosse. Hi, Steve.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking my call. This just seems so counterintuitive for anybody who cares about world health or family planning or population, and I just really appreciate you bringing it up. It sort of got lost, it seemed like, in all the flurry of presidential documents that have been released the last couple of weeks. So thank you so much.
Well, Steve, while you're with us, what is it about this executive order that you are really concerned about women's health around the globe?
Just giving low-income women access to health care is just so important, and especially child health, you know.
And Rachel, in terms of child health and in terms of spreading out pregnancies, what impact might these dollars have on that?
It starts to get a little hard to tell at that point, right? So those, you know, there is still funding at this point from the U.S. going towards family planning. We are one of the major supporters of family planning the world over. I think the most recent year it was about $600 million worth of assistance. And so that money per se, you know, a huge percentage of it should hopefully not be at risk. So we are still making major contributions to those areas. It's really through these more indirect pathways Should organizations, local organizations, local doctors, people working in country who are somehow reliant on U.S. funding, either directly or indirectly, should they change their behavior, either because, you know, they still wish to be able to counsel women on topics related to abortion, or just because they're concerned about losing their funding, then that's where the possible, you know, the sort of really negative ramifications might come into play.
And meanwhile, organizations like Refugees International has put forth this coalition statement on opposing it with more than 140 signatories. What do we know about some of the opposition going on around the world?
That is a topic with which I am less familiar with, mm-hmm. but in general, I can say, you know, these coalitions do form every time that the global gag rule or Mexico City policy is put into place. And one of the amazing things that happens, and I think this speaks to some of the strength of the international community, is that when there is a shortfall in U.S. funding, other governments do their best to try to pick up the slack. And so it's often the Nordic countries, so the Scandinavians and the Norwegians and the Dutch.
We heard the Danish government stepping up, I think I read.
Yeah, and it's just, it shouldn't have to be that way in some regards, but I think it speaks to the fact that the global reproductive health community is particularly strong because it has, you know, been under attack, I think, at so many points in the past. And so that network, you know, comes to the fore and does what it can.
Thanks, Steve, for your call. Let's go to Ben in La Crosse. Hi, Ben.
Hi. My comment has to do with the effects of reducing women's access to reproductive care. There are many experts that have pointed out that issues of global warming, mass migrations and immigration, refugees, the disparity of access to resources and income levels, and a number of different world crises issues are related directly to human population levels. So any policy that reduces women's access to reproductive care exacerbates those problems, those larger problems. Thank you.
Rachel?
Yes, the issue of population size and how it links to women's reproductive health, there have been many arguments used, you know, over the 20th century and into the 21st century, and it's a very malleable topic. Starting from the 1990s onwards, you know, one of the most potent arguments was in terms of improving women's reproductive rights and that would have beneficial impacts on socioeconomic development. But we've seen a rise, as the caller indicated, in terms of possible implications for global warming and maybe refugee crises, these types of things. I think the most important message at the end of the day is that there are widespread and multifaceted connected benefits to ensuring that all people can determine the number and timing of their children.
But looking at the other side here, there's a strain of thought that the U.S. should pull foreign aid altogether and focus on more domestic issues. Why do you think that people should care about this?
Well, I think that they should care about it for the same reason that we should care about health prevention. And essentially, prevention is always the best option because it's more expensive to fix a problem after it already happens. So if Americans want to protect against future disease outbreaks that might start someplace else but come to our shores, and, you know, the two most recent examples of that are Zika and Ebola, we will do best if we invest in strengthening health systems in poor countries. And this policy is really a step in the wrong direction for doing that. As I show in my forthcoming book, Intimate Interventions in Global Health, it was precisely the local family planning organizations in sub-Saharan Africa who sort of were the first to respond to HIV. And so they didn't come into existence because of HIV. They didn't get funding from the U.S. or anyone else because of HIV. But they were a resource that was there, and they were a resource that was in contexts that were severely, you know, severely under-resourced. And so when we pull funding for things that may seem like they're not related to health or other issues, we really run the risk of having something further down the road that will be very damaging.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us. That was Rachel Robinson, Associate Professor in the School of International Service at American University, talking about the Mexico City rule. And
now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
To sell its phonographic cabinets, a Grafton furniture business decided to start a record label. It became one of the leading producers of blues records in the 1920s and made pioneering recordings of some of the nation's great musicians. Sergio Gonzalez tells us the story of Paramount Records as part of Wisconsin 101.
The first time we heard about this was because Jack White's production company had just put out this huge collection of Paramount records. And so the first thing I heard was not the blues music. It was some of this quote-unquote ethnic music of Southern and Eastern European. The first time I heard it, I was like, this is not good. What is this? Like, why would people listen to this? You know, it didn't sound like anything special or particular. And it wasn't until you get to the blues that you really understood what made Paramount special. It was strictly a money-making project. So the Wisconsin Chair Company was founded in the 1880s, and they were really successful in Port Washington creating things like beds and cabinets. But with the introduction of phonographs in the late 19th and early 20th century, they decided to jump into that business, and they were making phonographic cabinets for corporations like the Edison Company. And they got to thinking, well, if we're making these phonographic cabinets, why don't we just start making some music as well? So they had purchased two different subsidiaries that had kind of ventured into the blues market, so Puritan Records and the New York Recording Laboratories. And really the thing that pushed them into the blues market was the hiring of J. Mayo Williams. He was a guy who was living in Chicago, and he had actually contacted this company and asked if he could be a talent recruiter for them. And he had a very special talent of finding unknown artists in the South and then bringing up to Chicago and eventually all the way up to Wisconsin to record music. So some of the big recorders, you had Louis Armstrong, Jelly Roll Morton, Ethel Waters, and Ma Rainey. But the big find for J. Mayo Williams is Blind Lemon Jefferson. The Grafton plant was made specifically to make cheap music. Artists would come all the way up from the South, stop in Grafton, and then because of the sundown laws in Grafton, would have to leave the city as African-American artists and head back to Milwaukee to find a place to stay. Paramount blew up in the 1920s, up until basically the Great Depression, where the entire music industry collapsed. At its height, the Wisconsin Chair Company employed 1/6 of all workers in Ozaukee County, and so they were a touchstone organization within the community. And so I would imagine a lot of people understood that company kind of being instrumental to, you know, their family's well-being. Like a lot of companies, Paramount Records did not treat their talent with a lot of respect, and specifically their black artists. They were paid considerably less than the rest of their artists on their slates. And so records show that 9 out of 10 Paramount recording artists never received any royalties from their music, and a lot of them were swindled out of the copyrights on their songs. And so they would write these fantastic songs, and Paramount would hold the rights to them, and the artists would never see really any profit off of that. Paramount records to this day are really hard to find because they were produced on these cheap wax masters that were made for immediate production but not made to last very long. And so people who purchased Paramount records knew that they were going to get great music but not very good quality. I think the amazing story about Paramount is that we're talking about one of the most important companies in the creation of blues music in the 1920s and early 1930s, and it was based here in Wisconsin, in a place that people wouldn't even think about.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.